Let's try to wrap up what we saw last week. We talked these past two Wednesdays about Lot and how Lot, though he was a Christian, was a backslider, and how a Christian very easily can slide back. And it's never anything, you know, major at first, is it? It's step by step, inch by inch, little by little, we slide away. And I like to use the illustration of a ladder. And when you're saved, God puts you on the ladder of salvation. Now, the ladder doesn't have a bottom, but he takes you from where you were, and he puts you on that ladder. And guess where you are when you first get saved? You're right on the top rung, holding hands with God and face-to-face communicating with him, if you please. That means we're in fellowship with him. Now, when I sin and you sin, we are not taken off the ladder, right? God doesn't take us out of the salvation experience and put us back over here into the realm of the lost. God doesn't do that. We, by our sin, knock ourselves down a rung, and the next one another rung, and we're no longer in fellowship, looking over the edge, you know. You get the picture, don't you? A nice plateau here and a ladder like this. When you're saved, you're right there looking at him face to face, and when you sin, you're right below the level. And you're still on the ladder, but you're no longer communicating with him face to face. And what separates you from the top of the ladder and from where you are? Those rungs, right? The sins that you have committed that you have not confessed. Now, when you confess the sins, then you go back up where you were. It's a very simple procedure, but most of us miss it. And Lot didn't start by saying, okay, I'm going to take 10 rungs down. Vroom! He went down 10 rungs. He did it just like we do it, one rung at a time, one rung at a time. And so the real danger for the believer, like Lot, is to become so insensitive to the downward movement that we just keep on, you know, going on down and don't see it until we do like the prodigal son. We look around and, what am I doing in the hog pen? Now, one of the ways you know that you're saved forever, once you're saved, you're always saved, is that God brings you back. And God did that, didn't he, with Lot? God sent Abram, and there was a big war in chapter 14. It's the first war ever recorded in the Bible in chapter 14. And there are, in this first two verses, we see seven. Is it seven? Yeah. Nine kings, four against five. And in verse 2, you see the king of Sodom, the king of Gomorrah, and three other cities. And those are on one side. And in verse 1, you have four other kings. And I mentioned that, Amraphel is the name we use for, the King James Bible uses for Hammurabi. And so these four pitted against these five, beat up on the five, and they took Sodom. And guess who lived in Sodom by this time? Lot. Now, Lot had pitched his tent originally towards Sodom. He wasn't in Sodom, but he eventually got there. He became so much like the world that he just was at home there. And so they took him and everything with him, and they run off with him. Now, Abram found out about that, and he took off after them. And it was amazing the effort with a few slaves that Abram went through to go and get Lot. And I made the comment that God never does leave his lots in Sodom, in captivity. If you're a child of God, God will come and take a switch and come after you. And if you rebel, he'll take a larger switch and come after you. And if you continue to rebel, he may take a baseball bat or a railroad tie. And finally, after you've rebelled and rebelled and rebelled, you'll either get right with him, which is the smart thing, or God will say, all right, you have crossed the boundary. You are now, and we talked about this in Romans a few Sundays back, on Sunday morning. You have now crossed what old J. Harold Smith used to call one of God's three deadlines. And you have now become more of a harm to the cause of Christ than you have become a benefit to it. And rather than you continue to live like that and my name be blasphemed, I'm going to call you home. And many Christians tonight are in heaven because, not because they had finished their course, they had run the race, they'd fought the good fight, but because they had failed miserably and God had to call him home. called them home. May it never be said that that has ever happened or ever will happen to members of South Heights Baptist Church, right? It should always be said that we fought the good fight like LeMay Reed. We finished our course and we've kept the faith all the way to the end. That's the way the Christian is to live. And Lot didn't do that. He slid back, and God threw Abram. Abram went after Lot, took him, took everything, and brought him back. Now, we see in verse 17, brothers, put in at verse 16, and then we'll go on to the rest of the chapter and finish. And he brought back, Abram, all of the goods, and also brought again his brother Lot. Notice his brother Lot. Brother Lot, he's his nephew, but he's called his brother. Why? Because he's a saved man. And his goods and the women also and the people. Now verse 17 is very interesting. Pardon me. The king of Sodom went out to meet Abram after his return from the slaughter of... Boy, I come to these words and I just say Moses and go on, but let me try it. Chedorlaomer. Okay, let's try that. If you just have a problem with a name in the Bible, just say Moses and go to the next one and you'll be all right. The slaughter of Chedorlaomer, Moses, and the kings that were with him at the Valley of Sheva, which is the king's dale. Now, in verse 18, we have a very important name, and you ought to take your pen out and circle this name with the biggest circle you can get and draw a line out to the margin of your Bible and say the most, and write this note, the most important character named in the Old Testament. You might want to say person. I don't want to say character, meaning he's a character, but the most important individual named in the Old Testament is not Adam, it's not Eve, it's not Abram, it's not Sarah. It is Melchizedek. He is the most important person mentioned in the Old Testament. Why? Well, let's read it and then we'll talk about it and tell you. And Melchizedek, king of Salem, the word Salem means peace, brought forth bread and wine, and he was the priest of the Most High God. And he, Melchizedek, blessed Abram and said, "Blessed be Abram of the Most High God, possessor of heaven and earth. And blessed be the Most High God, who hath delivered thine enemies into thy hand." Now, Melchizedek is very, very important. And I wish we could spend hours, if you've studied Melchizedek before, you know, we could spend hours and hours just studying the beautiful, beautiful parallels between the New and the Old Testament talking about Melchizedek. But suffice to say, he's mentioned in Hebrews chapter 7, and I want to read that to you from the New Testament. Hebrews chapter 7. Pardon me. I don't even sound like me tonight. Tell you what, I'm taking 4 grams of antibiotics a day, and I can sense it. Hebrews chapter 7. Doesn't do much for the sniffles, but it does a good job. Now, look at verse 1. "For this Melchizedek, king of Salem, priest of the Most High God, who met Abraham returning from the slaughter of the kings and blessed him, to whom also Abraham gave a tenth part of all, first being by interpretation king of righteousness, and after that also king of Salem, which is king of peace, without father, without mother, without descent, having neither beginning of days nor end of life, but made like unto the Son of God, abideth a priest continually." Now, consider how great this man was, unto whom even the patriarch Abraham gave the tenth of his spoils. And truly, they that are the sons of Levi, who received the office of the priesthood, have a commandment to take the tithes of the people according to the law, that is, of their brethren, though they come out of the loins of Abraham. But he whose descendant is not counted from them received tithes of Abraham, and blessed him that had the promises. And without all contradiction, the less is blessed of the better. And here men that die receive tithes, but there he receives them of whom it is witnessed that he lives. And as I may so say, Levi also, who received tithes, paid tithes in Abraham. For he was yet in the loins of his father when Melchizedek met him. In other words, there were no descendants of Abraham when Abram at that time brought tithes to Melchizedek. We'll read that in a moment. If therefore perfection were by the Levitical priesthood, for under it the people received the law, what further need was there that another priest should rise after the order of Melchizedek? Now who's our high priest, folks? Jesus, okay? That's the question he's asking. If you can get saved by living by the law, why did God send Jesus? That's a good question. And when you're talking to people who think they can live a good enough life and whatever reasons they give to be going to heaven when they die, and you say, well, if that's true, why did Jesus come? And you know, they will look at you like a deer looks at a car headlights coming down the road in the middle of the night. There's no answer for that. They just kind of look at you. Okay? So he says, for the priesthood being changed, there is made necessity a change also of the law. For he of whom these things are spoken pertains to another tribe, of which no man gave attendance at the altar. For it is evident that our Lord sprang out of Judah, of which tribe Moses spoke nothing concerning priesthood. And Jesus was of the tribe of Judah, you know. And it is yet far more evident that after the similitude of Melchizedek, there arises another priest who is now made not after the law of carnal or fleshly command, but after the power of an endless life. For he, Jesus, testify, or for he, the Old Testament says, thou art a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. And that's talked about in Psalms all over the place. For there is verily or truly a disannulling of the commandment going before the weakness and unprofitableness of it. Now that just means that when the veil of the temple was rent from top to bottom, the Old Testament sacrificial system was ended. And a new priesthood was begun, and of course we are part of that priesthood. Every individual believer is a priest, right? We Baptists are big on the priesthood of the believer. Every believer is a priest in and of his own right, and we have one high priest, not an earthly man, but a heavenly Son of God, capital S. Now, verse 19. For the law made nothing perfect. No one can get saved by the law, but the bringing in of a better hope did. Who's our hope? Who's our hope? Jesus. By the which, or the whom, we draw nigh unto God. See, we get near to God not because of the works we do, but because of the one who's our hope. That's Jesus. And inasmuch as, well, not without an oath, he was made a priest. For those priests here on earth were made without an oath. But this is with an oath by him that said unto him, the Lord swore and will not change his mind, thou art a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. Verse 22. By so much was Jesus made a surety, you ought to circle that, a surety of a better testament. The law is not, the law is inferior to the gospel. You've learned that, haven't you? Salvation by works is inferior to salvation by what? Grace. Grace. And that's what he's talking about here. Now, verse 23. And there were truly many priests, because they were not suffered to continue by reason of death. But this man, Jesus, because he continues forever, has an unchangeable priesthood. Wherefore he is able also, listen, boy, you ought to just, this, if this doesn't get your spiritual wood, fire going, your wood is wet. Whereby, or wherefore, he, Jesus, is able, right now, is able also to save them, that's those that believe on him, to the uttermost. God saves those from the guttermost to the uttermost, folks, to the uttermost that come unto God through him, seeing how come? Seeing that he lives to make intercession for them. Right now, Jesus makes intercession for you. He's your intercessor. For such an high priest became us, who is holy, harmless, undefiled, separate from sinners, and made higher than the heavens, who needs not daily, as the earthly high priest, to offer up sacrifice first for his own sins and then the people's. For this he did, boy, this is exciting. For this Jesus did once when he offered up himself. See, the earthly priest had to offer up sacrifices for his own sins, then for the people. But Jesus did it once for all. Remember the old song? Once for all. Okay, now look at verse 28. And we'll just, for the law makes men high priests who are sinners. That's what it means, have an infirmity. But the word of the oath, which was since the law, maketh the Son, capital S, who is consecrated forevermore. Now, let's go back to Genesis chapter 8 and let's talk about Melchizedek. Many scholars believe that Melchizedek here is Jesus before he came to earth virgin born. I don't know. I'm too young and I'm not wise enough to say I do know. Except sometimes the wisest thing you can say is, I don't know. I don't know whether it was Jesus or not, but I know this. There's some tremendous parallels. Let's look at them. First, we have no ancestry, or not parallels, but interesting comparisons and contrasts. He is a type of Jesus Christ. He is a picture of Jesus Christ here in Genesis chapter 14. He's very much a picture of Jesus. But it's interesting that Melchizedek isn't given an ancestry. We don't have a history of him. No idea where he came from. The reason that I think that God chose in the inspiration of the Old Testament scriptures not to give us a history of Melchizedek is because Jesus is without human father, without he was virgin born, you know, and he had no human father, and he really had no mother in the spiritual sense because he's God. So Melchizedek, I think, is not given to us with a family history because it pictures Jesus who has forever been here. Okay? Now, he's had a physical mother to come in the flesh, but that which is Jesus, which is like we are, that which is us is not this tent you live in. Or as someone said, this is, you know, you don't see me, you see the earth suit that I live in. And that which is really you is inside. And that which is really Jesus is eternal, okay, prior to the incarnation. And Melchizedek had no, was not given any, we didn't get any genealogy or his lineage because it pictures the fact that Jesus has always been. Okay, second thing I notice is he had no earthly parents, as I mentioned, and of course that's very important. He is the King of Peace. He's the King of Peace. See where it says King of Salem there in verse 18? He's the King of Peace, and of course Christ is the King of Righteousness and the King of Peace, according to Hebrews 7. Isn't that exciting? He's the King of Peace, Melchizedek, but Jesus is the King of Righteousness and Peace. Melchizedek, and by the way, I just have to throw this in, and the reason it is so important, and the reason that we make that comparison, because you can't be at peace unless you have the righteousness of Christ in your heart. See? Okay? Third thing I notice about Melchizedek, he was a king first, then he was a priest. Jesus came to this earth and was not allowed by the Jews to become king, so he became our priest first, and then he becomes a king. Melchizedek was a king and then a priest. Jesus came as a priest and then will come as king. Pretty neat comparison, don't you think? Let's look at what happened. And Melchizedek, verse 9, by the way, the king of Salem, I just have to throw this in, the king of Salem, king of peace, Jerusalem, that's where the name Jerusalem comes from. He was the king of Jerusalem. Okay? So that's interesting. God's always pointing us to Jerusalem. And here it is. Verse 7, and Melchizedek, he blessed Abram and said, blessed be Abram, the Most High God, possessor of heaven and earth, and blessed be the Most High God who hath delivered thine enemies into thy hand. And listen to this. And he, that's Abram, gave him, that's Melchizedek, tithes of everything, all. Now, you know where Baptist preachers go when you read the word tithe in the Bible, right? The word tithe is not mentioned, or tithing is not mentioned in the Bible until we read it here. This is the first mention of tithing in the Bible, and it was way before the law of Moses. Did you see that? We talked about that in Hebrews 7. The principle of tithing is I am to give 10% of all God has entrusted to me back to him. Really, not because I'm giving it back, but because he already owns it. Now, you may not have the ability. You may not have any money. You may be flat broke. Hey, you know that your 10% is not just, you know, dollars and cents. Did you know that? 10% of my life, my efforts, 10% of my goods. I remember my dad's mother telling me that during the Depression, people brought, and Mom, correct me on this, but am I not remembering right? That they brought 10% of the eggs that they raised, 10% of the bacon that they from the hogs they slaughtered. You know, in other words, 10% in just your money. You know, now our treasurer will get mad at me if I say, no, he won't either. But, you know, he'll want me to be sure and emphasize that that's included. But certainly, it's not limited to that. You know, you may be one of these people that does all kinds of things around the church that no one sees. You may repair things. You may clean things. You may do this. You may do that. You may donate money. You may donate goods. And all of that is part of giving back to God a portion, minimum of, you know, 10% is not the cutoff place. Did you know that? It's the starting place. That's the minimum. And so you may give, you know, 20, 30, 40%. Dr. George W. Truett, who was pastor at First Baptist Dallas, many years from 1897 to 1944, he gave sometimes more than his salary to the church in a year's time. Can you believe that? You know, every year they had a pledge card thing. Now, don't get paranoid on me. I'm not going to do that. But they'd have a pledge thing, and they would pledge how much they were going, that God laid on their heart to give every year. And some many years, especially in the later years, as he became more wise and more godly than he was in his younger years, he began to pledge way more than he was even salaried to get before the Depression even. And people would look at him and say, how in the world, Georgie, can you do that? And he would say, well, God will provide, and somehow he always did. And so you can never outgive God. Now, I've learned something I'm ashamed to say not too many years ago, and that is this. If you don't give God his tenth, he will take it from you one way or the other. You'll have a hospital bill you can't pay. You'll have a planned automobile problem that you can't afford to fix. And if you don't do it, and I can remember, you know, we give tithes, and as many of you do, in different ways. We give monies sometimes we buy things and we put them in the church. All of us should do that without asking for a claim. You know that? I think if someone wants to come and give the church $20,000 or $100,000, but they want their name placarded on the building that it's going to build, I think I'd probably turn them down. You know why? Because that person's not giving it, I don't think, to be seen by God. They're giving it to be seen by men. And if someone says, I'm not going to give you this money, preacher, unless you put my name on that building, I'm just going to tell them, keep their money. Now you really think I've lost my marbles, haven't you? But your money, your time, your talents are not to be limited by the applause of men. You know that? We should do what we do because we love God. And I hope that your tithing and my tithing is not just giving money, but it's doing. Giving things, giving our time, giving our talents. Boy, did you know God's going to hold us accountable for our talents? That which we could do for him that we didn't. And so it goes way beyond the material, okay, the financial. So just remember that. And I won't, if you're a visitor here tonight and this has been the first time in a long time you've been in church, don't go home saying, well, I went to church and sure enough, first thing the preacher talked about was money. You know, I don't really do that, so certainly wouldn't do it on a Sunday morning. But let's just finish this out. And the king of Sodom said unto Abram, give me the persons and take the goods yourself. Now, Abram's real smart. Abram said to the king, I have lifted up my hand to the Lord, the Most High God, the possessor of heaven and earth, that I will not take a thread, even to a shoestring. And that I will not take anything that is yours, lest thou should say, I have made Abraham rich. Now, you thought I was crazy just a minute ago saying about the person wanting to give us money with their name attached, but there it is. There it is. See, Abraham learned, listen, that he should not take anything from the world, if it means compromising what he knows is right. And folks, there was a popular evangelist a few years ago that some guy won a fortune in, I believe it was dog racing down in Florida. And, you know, he took the money. Now, folks, I don't know where you get your money, and it's none of my business. But I'm going to tell you, if we compromise and we get our money from an unholy place, an unholy method, and we are doing it, and I say, well, I'll go to Las Vegas, or I'll go to the casino. You know, they're coming up with these crazy, you know, they don't notice they're not calling it casino gambling this round. They're calling it casino gaming. Gaming. Pretty smart, huh? I'm going to go down there, and I'm going to win, you know, all this money, and they bring their tenth, you know, of that ill-gotten gain to the church, folks. The Bible's very clear that we are not to get something for nothing. We're not to get something for nothing. And the society, listen, the society that says that you can get something for nothing is is violating some very basic Bible principles. Number one and foremost is this. When you do that, you are literally taking food out of the mouths of children. I don't care how you want to slice it. You are literally taking things away from people, you know, who cannot afford to have it taken away from. And I'll just end this negative thing on this and then give you a positive, okay? We lived in Texas and they passed the state lottery. You know who the ones that are buying the most tickets? Folks on welfare. And we saw these poor, sweet young ladies who would get their food stamps. And, you know, they get change back for food stamps. Save up the change, and as soon as they got enough, they'd buy a lottery ticket. And they'd buy strings of them this long, desperately trying to win something for nothing. I used to go into the convenience store and say, why don't you just take a match and set fire to your dollar bill? And the ladies say, why? I said, you got just about as much chance. Now the state said, oh, you know what we're going to do with that money? We're going to put that into education. You know what? Not a dime of it got into education in Texas. And when we called the governor on the phone one day, one of those talk shows said, how come none of this money is in education? You're having to raise our taxes to pay for education in the state of Texas. I thought we were going to do that with that lottery you were talking about. And she said, oh, we never said that we were going to put that money in education. Boy, the phones just burn up on the radio station. Because, see, it's blood money. It's blood money. That's all it is. And God says, woe to the nation that builds its society, that builds itself on blood. Don't you be fooled by that. Don't you be fooled by that. Stand up for what is right. Now, Abram just beautifully does this in verse 24, and we're through. He says, I don't want you to give me anything lest you should say that I made Abram rich. Verse 24, except, save only that which the young men have eaten, and the portion of the men which went with me, Aner and Eshcol and Mamre, let them have their portion. He thought of his men, and folks, I think therein is a great place to stop, but I want to make a point as we do. We ought to think of others. We ought to think of others. You give your time and your money and your talents not to South Heights Baptist Church, okay? You certainly don't give it to me. I'm glad that as Baptist, I don't handle the money, and I don't want to handle the money. Had a lady visit our church a few months ago, and she had a big envelope full of her tithe, about that thick. And she just visited from another town, and she went to one of these churches where they give the preacher the money. And, of course, I got rid of it as quick as I could by giving it to Dane or, I don't know, Paul or somebody. I said, here, take this, you know, and you know, because I don't want anything to do with that. Because you don't give your money to a man, and you don't give your money to a group of men, and you don't give it to an institution. You give it to God. Now, you may be so financially strapped you can't give a dime, but you can give your time. You can give your talents. You can give your work and your heart. So no one is so bad off that they can't serve the Lord, or so well off that they can just pay a few dollars here and let someone else do it. Right? We're all in it together. Right? We're all serving God together. And that's what we're going to do. And if I had anything to say to our congregation over the next few months and years that we're going to be together, and I'm here for the long haul, whether you like it or not, I'm here. I'm not moving. I spent too many hours on the floors of that house polyurethaning to go anywhere soon. But we're here for the long haul, and if I could say anything to us, it would be this. We have to link arms. We have to link shields, like the Roman shields that they had, where they would link together and form a block, moving forward for God in our town, in our community, in our county, and across this part of the state. I mean, folks, in a town this size, there's no reason why next year we can't have 500 people in backyard Bible clubs. By this time next year, there's no reason why we can't be running 500 in Sunday school. There's no reason why in 5 years we can't be running 1,000 in Sunday school. There's no reason why in 10 years we can't have 2,000 in here baptizing, like the Bible says, daily. Enough to add up daily. And I'm telling you, folks, there's enough people in this town, we can do that, but we'll never do it under our own strength. We will only do it like we did last week, linking arms, moving together, joining as a body, singular, serving God as He gives us time, as He gives us talent and abilities. Let's bow for just a second of prayer, and then we'll go into our business meeting. Father, thank you so much for all that you've done for us. Father, thank you for everyone that's here tonight, and I just praise you for them. And Lord, I just pray as we plan for and as we live for Jesus in the days that lie ahead, and as we work toward building your work here, you will help us never lose sight of the fact that we have a lost and dying community out there who, without someone to tell them about Jesus, they're not going to go to heaven when they die. Help us, Lord, if we're the only ones left in the whole state of Oklahoma, if we're the only ones left, help us to be faithful, to preach the word, to study it and learn it, and to be able to to share it so that we can win people to Christ and become the kind of body of believers you want us to be. For it's in Christ's name we ask it. Amen.